Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002, Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1066, I will air an interview Hanan Awad conducted with Salim Tamari, a Palestinian sociologist and historian, who serves as a research associate for the Institute for Palestine Studies and is the editor of the Jerusalem Quarterly. It is a very interesting interview, a virtual return to Jaffa. It is part of Arab Voices Nakba 75 special episodes as we continue to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the ongoing Palestinian Nakba or catastrophe. Let's listen in.
Salam, this is your host, Hanan Awad, from Arab Voices. This month, we have a special series of episodes in commemoration of the 75th anniversary of al-Nakba, which translates to the catastrophe. In this episode of Arab Voices, our distinguished guest will be the Palestinian sociologist and historian, Professor Salim Tamari. Salim Tamari is a professor of sociology at Bir Zeit University in Palestine. He also serves as a research associate for the Institute for Palestine Studies and is the editor of the Jerusalem Quarterly. Salim's work has explored the history of Jerusalem and its people from the end of the Ottoman era up until the beginning of the British Mandate and beyond. Professor Tamari has authored several works on urban culture, political sociology, biography, and social history. To put it simply, his work deals with the sociocultural histories of Palestine. Al-Nakba is not only a commemoration of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, but also a reminder of the ongoing settler colonialism in the country. Palestinians recognize May 15th as the Day of Remembrance of the genocidal massacres that occurred across the land in 1948. Over 400 villages were destroyed and 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homeland. Today, our conversation with Professor Tamari will revolve around his virtual return to Jaffa. Jaffa, once a thriving commercial and cultural hub of Arab Palestine, held significant importance before the Nakba in 1948. In late April of that year, the city fell into the hands of the Zionist forces, such as Haganah and the Irgun. Only a few thousand individuals remained, while the rest were forcibly expelled from their houses and their country. Professor Tamari will discuss the changes that Jaffa City has undergone since the Nakba in 1948 and will describe his revisit of Jaffa City after many years away. Welcome back to Arab Voices, Professor Salim Tamari. We are pleased and honored to have you again with us on our show.
Thank you for having me.
It's never enough with you, and we always love to have you. You were a child when you were born in Jaffa, and you were a child when you were displaced with your family in 1948. I want you to tell us, what do you remember from your childhood? What do you remember growing up with your parents who were very young at that time when they left Jaffa and they experienced the Nakba?
Well, I was 2 years old, so my memory of it is the memory transmitted by my family after the war, when we moved as refugees to Lebanon. And as a child, my mother and father would tell me about life in Jaffa. And they did not actually discuss the circumstances of leaving Jaffa until my father died in 1976. The events were so traumatic for them that somehow my mother, when we were occupied, we had moved from Lebanon to Ramallah in 1951 after spending 5 years in Lebanon. So basically, I grew up in the city of Ramallah. And after 67, my mother and I went once to Jaffa in the early 70s when movement became more possible for people under occupation in the West Bank. And I remember that the visit was so traumatic to her. We went to both my father's family house and to her own family's house. And that place was occupied by a Moroccan Jewish family who would not let us into my mother's house. She was very traumatized by the experience, and she actually refused to go back again. So she died about 6 or 7 years ago. And from 67 until that one visit in the early 70s, she never went back to Jaffa again. But after that visit, she began to discuss with me the circumstances of leaving. In 98, there was the 50th anniversary of the Nakba. So there was a lot of commemorative meetings about the refugee experience and what happened half a century earlier. And that's when she began to talk about it and discuss. But she always was in her mind living in Jaffa and talking about Beirut and Ramallah and the West Bank as if it was a transitory moment. She was not hoping that she would go back. She was hoping that she would be back, but she was not at all having any vision of the refugees going back after the experience of the War of 67. So all the memories I have were memories that came back after my starting of visiting the state, the city. And that is when I began to write blogs with a number of Jaffa refugees. A version of it appeared in the essay that you referred to as Virtual Return to Jaffa. The possibility of return was always alive until the War of 67 occurred. And that experience was so devastating. You remember, or you probably don't remember, but you understand that the military defeat of the Arab countries, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon in the war, was the end of the Nasserist period, when hopes for Arab unity, for the liberation of Palestine by the surrounding Arab countries, and the rise of the PLO as an alternative to that defeat in 67, all of that produced a bitter experience that was only rekindled with the emergence of the various PLO groups in Lebanon and Jordan and Syria. So that triggered the possibility of thinking of how the Palestinians can reassert themselves, invested in the Arab armies, in the Arab regimes, particularly in the regime of Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, had fallen apart. And the experience between 67 and the first two decades after that was the experience of occupation. So although we were able to go and visit Jaffa, which was by that time was a devastated city, was a bitter visit, a bitter experience, especially for her, because she remembered Jaffa as a thriving city. She remembered the social life in it. She remembered the properties, the social clubs that they used to go to. And all of this, by the end of her life, was one that can be described as one of sorrow only. Jaffa that she went back to was not the Jaffa that she remembered. Even though thriving Arab communities, which was reduced from about 120,000 people to 2,000, almost within weeks after 48, was a broken community that was trying to survive and rebuild their lives. It was not the Jaffa that she remembered. It was not the Jaffa she was talking about since then, and therefore there was a split vision in her mind. The Jaffa that was and the Jaffa that was reduced to squalor after that. With me, it's different. With me, 67 was, even though it was a vision of defeat, was also a vision of reuniting with families, friends, people that we have lost contact with completely between the two wars. And therefore, we began to have a different perspective about it, how to rebuild our lives, how to rebuild our continuity with the people of Jaffa. And it was not it was a mixture of nostalgia and manner in which the reuniting of the two components of the Palestinian people, those in the occupied territories and those who remained in what became the state of Israel, was very problematic. Problematic because it ended in the 1990s with the establishment of a broken autonomous region called Palestinian Authority, and not the vision of return that the people of Palestine were talking about.
Yeah, interesting. And interesting how both of you had different visions, how she kind of looked at it and 1967, the defeat, and how you looked at it as you really wanted to enter the land and to get to Jaffa and to reunite, like you said. Can we briefly talk about what exactly took place in May or late April, early May 1948 in Jaffa, and briefly explain to the audience who are the Haganah troops, who are the Argun troops, and where did they come from?
The actual fighting began immediately after the partition plan in November 1947. That period saw a number of clashes around the major cities and in the countryside. Remember that in 48 was only 8 years after the defeat of the 1936-39 rebellion. So the people of the partisan who were active in Palestine at the time had been disarmed by the British Army and by the Zionists. The leadership was exiled to the seashores by the British. There were 50,000 troops that were brought from Egypt to quell the rebellion. The prisons were full of the rebels. Thousands of people had been killed and hunted by the Israelis. So in 48, the two remaining fighting forces were a remnant of a vibrant rebellious community, but they were unable to stand up to the organized, disciplined, highly supported groups that constituted the Jewish forces, which were made up by the central Zionist group called the Haganah, and by two right-wing revanchist groups called the Stern Gang and the Lehi group. The latter were supported by the leadership of Menachem Begin. The Haganah was led by Ben-Gurion and his groups. So these people began to prepare themselves in a highly organized way to the consequences of British withdrawal on May 15th, but they started their clashes with the Arab forces much earlier. In Jaffa, we had a group called Najada, which was militias made up from armed civilians in the city, supported by the from the north by Fawzi Qawwakshi's group, and in the southern part by the Jihad al-Muqaddas led by Abdul Qadir al-Husseini. So there were three groups fighting, and they were certainly not up to the discipline, organization, and support that the Zionist groups were able to muster. In Jaffa, the heavy bombardment of the city began in the spring of 48, around April. And that bombardment, which started from the north, from the Tel Aviv area, attacking Manshiya, which is the northernmost suburb of Jaffa, and from the south, from the Bat Yam region, made a clinching corridor over the civilian population of Jaffa, and only a corridor was open for the refugees to leave from the eastern part through the Azur, Ramla, and Lid region, and later on from the sea. So thousands of people began to leave as a result of the bombardment. And the decisive factor was the ability of the Haganah and the Lehi group to cut the water supply and the electricity from the city. So life became unbearable. Food supplies started coming to the city, and the civilian population started leaving in earnest around April, which is April, May, saw the massive depletion of the civilian population. At the end of the encirclement, only the sea was open, and the tens of thousands of people began to leave by sea to Gaza and to the north, mostly to Lebanon. In my family's case, we left in April. My father had a car. We were a middle-class family with a car. So we drove through Yazur, Ramla, and Lid to Ramallah, and from Ramallah, where my uncle's family lived, we continued to Lebanon through Jordan. So it was a huge corridor or a caravan of people leaving by foot, on donkeys, by trucks, by buses, and so on. And of course, the most horrendous march was from the Ramla Lid region, which where people left by foot after the massacre of Lidda. That included the families of people like George Habash, who became the leader of the Popular Front, and hundreds of thousands of people who vacated the country and made the refugee population.
I'm going to go back to your article titled Virtual Return to Jaffa, which describes your revisit of your city after many years away. But you mentioned earlier that you did visit Jaffa when you were much younger with your mother. But how did it feel for you to return to Jaffa now?
That was 1995 when I wrote that piece.
Yeah.
It was published in 98, I think. It was actually, I should not exaggerate the nature of that essay. There was a group of people who came from Jaffa who started a listserv. A listserv is a kind of electronic exchange which would be called a blog today. And people started meeting fellow Jaffites, people like Andre Mazawi, and Fakhri Jdai, who was related to my family. We would go periodically to Jaffa to visit. And we were actually very impressed by the resilience and survival capacity of the people who remained in Jaffa. Now, remember, in Jaffa, only 2,000 people remained from the city. But by the 1970s, a thriving community came to Jaffa for work and study from all the Arab villages and cities in the north, mostly in the Galilee. Jaffa became like a work center for them. And that 2000 had grown to about 25,000 people by the 70s. They constituted about a fifth of the population. The people who occupied their houses were mostly Yemenite and Bulgarian Jewish immigrants who came and resettled in the homes of the Arab population whose property was confiscated, sequestered, pillaged, and so on. The core of this group was a group of Bulgarian Jews who had became who came to Israel not necessarily as Zionists, but as refugees from Eastern Europe and from the Nazi-occupied territories. Many of them had already been allowed in by the British before that, but the main influx happened after 48. And the core of the Jewish settler population was Bulgarians, Bulgarian Jews. So the remaining Arab population of Jaffa were surrounded and by Zionist state providing the sequestered and vacated houses of the Palestinian refugees by these new Jewish refugees. And these Jewish refugee settlers became, of course, the majority. And Jaffa itself was annexed to the city of Tel Aviv, whose name was, a greater municipal council was called the Tel Aviv-Jaffa municipality. So the resilience of these people was astounding. They were able to rebuild their lives. They started their own schools. Quite a few of the schools had belonged to the Orthodox and Catholic and Protestant missions in Jaffa, like the Freyr School and the Orthodox School of Jaffa. And of course, the government schools were now controlled by the Israelis, and Hebrew was the main language of instruction in them.
Do you think that the Israelis wanted to ethnic cleanse Jaffa from all the Palestinian people to actually, let's say, erase the name Jaffa and make greater Tel Aviv?
Well, that was the purpose, of course, but they could not erase Jaffa for a number of reasons. Jaffa was a very important metropolitan city, not only for the Palestinian Arabs, but also an international economic place for the marketing of oranges, soaps, olive oil, which was exported from that. So it was an international city. And Israelis also, for example, the name Jaffa Oranges was an important name for marketing citrus for the Israelis who took over the orange groves, the Bayarat. So the name Jaffa remained because it was a marketing device. And I should say that the one thing that you have to remember is that Jaffa was a city enclave in the partition plat of 1947 that was earmarked for the Arab state. So the Arab state was constituted of an area larger than the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the city of Jaffa, whereas Jerusalem was earmarked to be an international city. Of course, all of that was left in shambles by the war itself. The Israeli forces had pushed themselves to much larger area than those allocated to the Jewish state. The remaining part of the West Bank was annexed to Jordan by the Jericho Conference 1951, and the Gaza Strip, also reduced, was now administered by the Egyptian forces under Egyptian control. So that was the background to the defeat of 48. And the city of Jaffa, which surrendered in May by the leading group of Jaffites who remained there, was by that time vacated from its population, of course, but the remaining population remained there. We're hoping that it would be an open city. The Israelis had reneged to this agreement of an open city and just annexed the town to the greater Tel Aviv area.
Interesting. We're going to go back now to your article, Virtual Return to Jaffa, where in this article, it paints a very vivid picture of your visit to the city and the complex emotions and experiences you encountered yourself. So you're gonna be personal here. I want you to elaborate on the significance of this journey for you personally and how it affected your understanding of your own identity as a Palestinian and connection to the city.
Well, that essay actually is not an essay. It's a concocted from a number of listserv articles, email exchanges which I had with a number of expatriates and refugees from Jaffa and local Jaffa residents. And so it's a series like 12 or 14 different blogs, as we would call them today. And a lot of it actually, it may sound nostalgic to you, but was mostly satirical, was laughing about ourselves, about our yearnings, about our encounter with the remaining people of Jaffa, some of whom were my family. A section of my family actually remained in Jaffa. The Jdai family, who owned the Kamal pharmacy at the heart of the city. So these were my guides. These are the people who reintroduced me to the city. And from them, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about survival, about resilience, about how to cope with adversity, and so on. Of course, they were Israeli citizens by then, second-class citizens, and we were, of course, had become stateless again because the Israelis took over the West Bank. So it was a bittersweet experience that if you read the article, which was stitched together from these number of offerings, if I have to write it again, it will be completely different. But when I read it today, I feel a bit embarrassed, actually, about things I said, about the sarcasm that I made about people I encountered. But it was a way of coping with the bitterness of the experience. And one feature of it that I think you had referred to earlier was a visit to the cemetery. That was probably the most dramatic part of my intervention. We went to see the tombs, the graves of my family, of the Tamari family. And to our great shock, we saw first the debilitated nature of the cemetery, the few tombstones that still had their writings, their shahid, were of people I knew the names of the families. I couldn't find any of my folks except a great uncle of my cousins, by the name of Julius Dabas. But the shock was to see so many of these tombs having their shahid, the writing of the tomb, replaced by Russian shahid. Now, that was a shock. It took me some time to understand what was going. Why was it filled with Russian, Cyrillic, and Hebrew marking with the Christian cross on it? So it turned out by that time that Jaffa had become an abode of a huge number of Soviet immigrants who came to Israel after the Reagan agreement with the US allowing Soviet Jews to come to Israel. But of course, about half of the so-called Soviet Jews who came to Israel were actually Christian Jews, Orthodox. And when they mostly wanted to go to the US, but the Americans made a deal with the Soviet authority that allowed them to go to Israel instead of going to the US. And so they came and settled in the major cities. One of the cities was Jaffa. And when they died, they had to be buried in the Christian cemetery. And the Christian cemetery was made up of the Orthodox and Catholic cemeteries in Jaffa. So what they did was to remove the graves of the Arab population and put the covering on it written in Russian. And that explains the remark made by Pshara Domani at the time. He says, first they took the country, then they took the homes, then they took the property, and now they're occupying our graves.
You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. What we are listening to is the interview Hanan Awad conducted with Salim Tamari, a Palestinian sociologist and historian who serves as a research associate for the Institute for Palestine Studies and is the editor of the Jerusalem Quarterly. It is part of Arab Voices Nakba 75 special episodes as we continue to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the ongoing Palestinian Nakba or catastrophe. Let's continue listening to the rest of that interview.
Wow, this is this visit raises questions, the visit to the cemetery, about the ownership and control of space in Jaffa. Very interesting. Can you tell me more about the museum visit and how you saw the Jewish narrative, the Israeli Zionist narrative, taken over with their stories in the museum?
Yes, Jaffa, of course, became a major tourist attraction center because when the Israeli took over the city, they took the old city of Jaffa, which is the section of town on the hill overlooking the sea, was now totally devoid or abandoned by the Arab population. And the Israelis made an artist colony out of it. And in the yard in front of the artist colony, they made a museum for the city. So the museum still exists, but it keeps changing its narrative. When I went there, the narrative was that Jaffa was liberated by the Irgun and the Haganah in 1948. They list the series of people who inhabited the city, from the Canaanites to the Philistines to the Crusaders. And there was a passing reference to the Islamic armies that came with Umar ibn Khattab and Khalid ibn Walid. And the city somehow makes a quick transit to the so-called liberation of Jaffa and the establishment of a new Jewish city, restored, so they said, to its original population, even though Jaffa was never actually a Jewish city. Even during the Israelite kingdom, Jaffa was part of the Philistine coastal inhabited population. So it was not really a Jewish city to be restored. But the narrative in that museum, written mostly for tourists, and in all languages except Arabic, there were French, Italian, Spanish, Hebrew, German, but not Arabic. So there was something so aggressive about that narrative in Jaffa that nowadays, I should say that the Israelis began to modify that narrative to give some credence to the presence of a thriving Arab community before 48. So they made some adjustments to that, but it's still a very Zionist narrative of displacement.
Why do you think that they're trying to do these adjustments now after all these years?
The reason is because by the 1990s, the Palestinian narrative had contested the Israeli Zionist narrative in a very effective way, partly because also the revisionist Israeli new historians who pointed out the falsity and brainwashing features of the older narrative. So that had major effects, but also I think the fact that by the 1990s it was clear that the Palestinians will not disappear and that their narrative at the scholarly academic level, but also at the political level, began to have an impact. So the Israelis had to take cognizance of that narrative. And by that time, the Arab community, not in Jaffa only, but in all of Israel, began to organize themselves in a very effective way at the cultural, literary, and certainly political level, that their voice had to be heard. And now we have a major son of Jaffa, Sami Abu Shadi, who's the leader of the Tajammu party, who until recently was leading a number of parliamentary seats, and they have two members of their community in the city council, the Tel Aviv Jaffa City Council. So they, for example, they began to rename the streets, restoring some of the names of the Palestinian streets that existed before 48. They renovated some of the icons of the area, and the mosques have been renovated. Hassan Beik Mosque, which was a major mosque in Manshiye, was renovated and is back now functioning as a community center. So things have changed, and things have changed actually in a way that makes the downtrodden, marginalized community very proud of their history and very assertive in making their demands as a represented community, both at the level of the city council and in the parliament. Tajammu was defeated in the last elections, and the new extreme right-wing government is restarting the war against Jaffa again. And one feature of that war, and by war I mean the trying to establish hegemony through Zionist iconography, was the gentrification of the city from abandoned Arab houses into an abode for rich investors. A lot of European, American, and Israeli Jews now see a property in Jaffa as something very quaint, something very valuable to have. So they began to do a second form displacement by this process of gentrification. However, this gentrification, which is the second wave of displacement, is not succeeding. It's not succeeding because the vast majority of Jaffa citizens, the Palestinian citizens, refuse to budge, and they have stayed steadfast there. They have their schools, they have their community services, they have their literary clubs, they have their newspapers, and Jaffa is back on the map as a Palestinian Arab city in the heart of Israel.
Interesting, after that rapid transformation of the city. But also you mentioned in your article, and you also did say that if you write it right now, you'll write it differently and you'll probably say other stuff. I'm not sure what exactly you will change, but you explained that the city became a tourist attraction, and it seems as like all these places like Ain Hod, the small village, or Ain Karim, or what they want to do to Lifta, or any other like places in Palestine, they restore these old homes And it attracts Jewish artists, and it becomes, like you said, like a place for like rich people and people just to come for tourism. Do you think this is changing now?
It is changing, yes, but the demographic battle, of course, has been lost because the even though the Arab community is growing up, growing demographically, it cannot cope with the large number of Jewish settlers and the investors who come and claim the city. It's Jaffa now. Is a showcase for a process of gentrification which is taking place all over the country. The case of Jaffa is different from areas like Haifa, for example. In Haifa, the Arab community was not only larger, but much more cohesive and able to assert its identity in a way that the Zionist scheme did not succeed. So even though there are gentrification of Arab neighborhoods in Haifa, or I should say the remaining Arab neighborhoods like Wadi Salib and Wadi Nisnas, the Arab community there was much larger, much more cohesive, and I should also add, much more educated, that the feeling of Palestinian identity is much more robust in a city like Haifa and in Nazareth than it is in Jaffa. Jaffa is a sadder case. I perhaps exaggerated the amount of resilience and robust assertiveness of the Arab community in Jaffa, but it does not really compare with the success stories that we see in Haifa or Nazareth. Jaffa is more like Akka. Akka also saw similar destruction of the Arab community and encirclement of the remaining Palestinians who stayed there. But the demographic hegemony of the settler population, of the Jewish Israeli population, is much more formidable in places like Akka and Jaffa.
This is going to take me to ask you a question about your encounter with a Palestinian who did not leave Jaffa. I think her name was Morjana, a young woman who grew up in Jaffa. But you explained that she lacked the connection to the city, like as if you are connected to Jaffa more than her, and she grew up in the area in Jaffa, and she moved back and forth in like nearby cities. How do you interpret her perspective, and what does it reveals about the complicity of reclaiming a sense of home, a sense of belonging?
Murjana actually is a name I used for a number of people. I invented that name. It's not her real name, but to me she was emblematic, symbolic of the people who grew up in the Israeli education system, who lost command of the language, whose national identity was sort of very murky, and it constitutes a large number of the new generations who grow up in Jaffa under the Israeli flag. And it's contrasted with people like Andre and Sami Abu Shadi, who established deep roots with their origins and were able to rekindled the Palestinian identity in a completely different context as Israeli citizens, and combat the liquidationist and and destructive nature of the Israeli scheme to marginalize the Arab population. But she is a very, she represents a large number of young Arabs whose, I would not say loss of identity, but whose coherent Palestinian identity is very murky. And today you see both sides, not in combat, but in conflict with each other, because they have to make a living with the new economy that emerged. They have to deal with their parents' language in a way that does not bring them employment, because you have to deal with the Hebrew education system if you want to find employment. But Murjana was actually a sad case. I perhaps was very unduly satirical about describing them in the manner that Emil Habibi also described the conditions in Haifa after the war. But I think you still see Murjana in a large number of Israelis, Palestinians who are trying to find a new identity for themselves. And that identity, on the one hand, is reflected in the large number of Palestinians who vote for Arab parties in the parliamentary elections, and those who vote for the Zionist parties at the most formal level. And they are divided almost into half. About half the Palestinian population, not only in Jaffa, but in the rest of the country, vote for Zionist parties. So that sort of identity loss is reflected in that electoral pattern.
Interesting. So there's a lot of Murjanas, but we're talking about 20 years ago when this article was written. So we understand it was because of the lack of education, the lack of the Palestinian narrative in their history books, and being sheltered and not knowing what really took place 75 years ago, or at that time, 55 years ago. But today, in with the speed of this technology and this social media, with the Instagram and the TikTok, and with all these TV channels that are just like going so fast, I feel that like the Palestinian narrative is coming back to every house, whether you are in Jaffa and you were sheltered from that narrative or not. Do you think this is making a difference today with the Palestinians who live in 1948?
Well, I like to be optimistic, but the fact is I think the cultural battle has been won. The battle for asserting a national Palestinian have been won. But the practical implications of that victory is not clear, because even though the vast majority of Palestinians in Jaffa and in the State of Israel identify themselves as Palestinians, they're not always proud of their Arab heritage, because they see the Arabs occupying the lowest placement in the pyramid in terms of jobs, in terms of community level. On the other hand, the Arabic language has been making major strides in articulating itself as the language of these people, and they have access to universities, both in the occupied territories, in the West Bank, and not in Gaza anymore, but they have access to movement to the Arab world, to Jordan, Egypt. And therefore, their national identity, both as Arabs and as Palestinians, have become much more pronounced than ever before. Where are they heading? It's politically, the situation is not very hopeful, because if they go into the parliamentary game, at best they can only affect the nature of coalition government that emerges, and the extreme right, which is now controlling the state of Israel, leaves very little ability to maneuver within that context. But the battle for culture actually is much wider and much more metaphysical than the political game. And I think because of the medias that you refer to, not only TikTok and social media, but the articulation of your identity through communities, through newspapers, through television, has established a niche for themselves that makes the Israeli attempt to make these people disappear culturally, if not physically, has been lost. And I think at that level, at the cultural level, there's a lot to be hoped for in the coming decades.
Yeah, I really don't want to end this with you, because it's never enough with you, like I said. But my last question to you is, looking ahead, what do you envision as a hopeful future for Jaffa and for Palestine as a whole? Do you feel there's any hope to reunite and get everything back?
Well, it's very hard to answer this question, but if you look at Jaffa as a city, there's a lot happening that gives us hope. There is a living theater, there's a number of musical groups, there is a number of cultural organizations that attract increasing number of Palestinians. There's a professional class that is asserting itself in the country as a whole, but it's taking place within the context of the state of Israel and Israeli citizenry. On the other hand, the conflict with the Palestinian population in Gaza and the West Bank is forcing the state of Israel to redefine itself, either by destroying, demolishing any possibility for a two-state solution after the Oslo Agreement, or by thinking of a kind of polity that would incorporate the Jews and Arabs in one national frame. The contours of this direction of this will take place is very hard to think at the moment. But I think the global wars that the Arab world have fallen onto in the last decade in Syria and Yemen and now in Sudan is forcing the Palestinians to think for themselves. The idea of relying on the Arab world as a fulcrum to assert their national aspirations, the right of return, their rights as citizens, are again going back to the situation which existed after 1967. That is a struggle where the Arab world is no longer the basis of aspirations for Palestinian self-determination. And that battle is going to be very hard. And as I said, it's going to be fought not only at the political level, but at the cultural level. We may be winning the cultural war, but I'm not sure if we're winning the political war.
Interesting. You said perhaps we are winning the cultural war, but not the political war. This month marks the 75th year of the ongoing Nakba. So do you mean we are gaining our culture back, but not our political win? What is your vision for Jaffa and Palestine for the future?
Well, I mean, you have to think in terms of long-term vision. If you think in terms of the coming years, we may come to a very pessimistic, but we have to think of how things change in a drastic way every decade. If you take the decades following the 67 war, you will see that the Palestinian vision has redefined itself again and again, learning from its mistakes, not always learning positively from their mistakes, but I think, for example, if a war happens now, if another war happens inside the country, the attempt of the Israelis to push the population out is very unlikely to happen. In other words, it's very unlikely to think of a repeat of the Nakba, population expulsion again at the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, because at least people learn from that mistake. And that perhaps is a pessimistic note to end our discussion, but it's something to hold on to. People, after 3 and 4 generations of the Nakba, people are determined not to allow it to happen again.
Thank you very much, Professor Salim Tamari, for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you all enjoyed this conversation with Professor Salim Tamari as much as I did. Thank you, Arab Voices, for making this podcast possible. Once again, thank you, Professor Tamari, for this wonderful conversation. Until next time, salam.
What you just heard was an interview Hanan Awad conducted with Salim Tamari, a Palestinian sociologist and historian who serves as a research associate for the Institute for Palestine Studies and is the editor of the Jerusalem Quarterly. It is part of Arab Voices Nakba 75 special episodes as we continue to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the ongoing Palestinian Nakba or catastrophe. Thank you very much, Hanan, for your great contributions to Arab Voices with these Nakba 75 special episodes. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.